The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
If everyone could come in and take their seats so we can begin the next session. The next session, which is on the future of international incitement law, a topic which is near to my heart, given that it focuses primarily on the predecessor actions of mass killing, genocide, the deliberate destruction of a racial, ethnic, or religious group, and critically important and often overlooked are how the dissemination of ideas, the transmission of speech, can lead to the perpetration of mass atrocities against individual victims from disparate parts of the world. We're privileged today to have a very distinguished panel of experts to talk about the future of incitement law. Before we get into each of the individual discussants' presentations, I'll quickly give a brief overview and then let our distinguished panel begin. The jurisprudence of international incitement law begins primarily with the IMT, the holdings of the IMT's decisions in Julius Streicher, convicting him for incitement to commit genocide, the acquittal of Hans Fritsch. It touches very much on some delicate issues as we move forward through to the ICTR, the Akiyesu case, Nahamina, the use of radio transmission in Rwanda to instigate and incite people to conduct mass killings, the transmission of the names of individual victims, license plates, to direct people to go out and kill. But at the same time, it also brings to mind some delicate issues of free speech. At what point courts often struggle to determine when it is that internationally protected norms regarding hate speech and other speech cross the line and become criminal? When do those values that are embodied in various international covenants to protect freedom of speech cross the line and become criminally prohibited? And that's a difficult question to ask, simply because the crime of incitement is treated under international law and international criminal law as if the perpetrator was one who actually pulled the trigger. And it also, when the speech crosses over into the realm of international prohibited incitement to commit genocide, demands that states take action to prevent and punish. And so again, these are very difficult questions that one must keep in line, because ultimately, once that speech crosses over, it leads ultimately to mass killing, but as in recent jurisprudence out of the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda has opined, even speech which might cross the line and constitute incitement but doesn't result in actual prohibited act of killing can constitute a prohibited and criminal activity. So you're left with a situation where someone can be punished for genocide when no one is actually killed. All of these are difficult topics, and all of these are areas which I'm sure our distinguished panel will address as we move forward. And I'm privileged to sit at the table with three very well-known and renowned speakers. The first, Judge Pile, who is a judge in the Appellate Division of the International Criminal Court. Judge Pile served from 1967 as an attorney in Durban, was a defense attorney for members of the ANC, the Unity Movement, the ZAPO, the Black Conscious Movement, the Train Units, and SWAPO. She's very well known in the field. She's the honorary chair of Equality Now, an international human rights organization for women based in New York. She successfully argued and brought a groundbreaking application in the Cape High Court, which spelled out the rights of the Robben Island political prisoners. Judge Pile was the first black woman to be appointed as an acting judge of the Supreme Court of South Africa and is a lecturer at Natal University, and it's an honor to be sitting on the panel with her. And I would turn it over to her to begin.
Thank you very much for that introduction. The subject of the law of incitement has time resonance post 9/11 and post London bombing, incidents where the state is introducing legislation with the aim of criminalizing speech. And as the ICC has yet to commence proceedings, I'm going to look at the law that was expounded in the ICTR in what we call the media case on which I presided. And I'd like to acknowledge initially the assistance that we received from the War Crimes Research Unit set up by the American University, in particular Diane Oren-Leiker and John Cerrone. We had access to their research on the subject of incitement and the crime of persecution. The media case is Ferdinand Nahimana, John Bosco Baragwiza, and Hassan Ingaza, and it's case number ICTR 99/52/T. This case resulted in the conviction of these three accused persons, and they have been sentenced to life imprisonment and a period of 35 years in imprisonment for Baragwiza. The case is subject to appeal and is now before the appeal chamber of the ICTR, and therefore I'm going to confine myself to what the trial chamber found in respect of its factual findings and legal findings. Nahimana is a professor of history, dean of the Faculty of Letters at the National University of Rwanda. He was also the founder and director, a member of the steering committee of the RTLM radio station. John Bosco Baragwiza, a lawyer, was the director of political affairs in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. He was the founder of the CDR, Hutu political party, and he was founder and member of the steering committee of the RTLM radio station. And Hassan Ingaza was the owner, editor, and journalist on the newspaper called Kangura. So all these three persons were charged jointly in a conspiracy on counts of genocide, conspiracy, and direct and public incitement to commit genocide. Since Nuremberg, this case then is the first decision by an international court interpreting and applying the law on incitement. I thought before I look into the way we interpreted and applied the law, I should give you an idea of the factual findings and some of the evidence that we heard. We found that within the context of hostilities between the RPF and the Rwandan government, the Tutsi population within the country was systematically targeted as suspected RPF accomplices. And following the shooting down of the plane carrying President Habyarimana on 6 April 1994, widespread and systematic killing of Tutsi civilians, a genocide, commenced in Rwanda. We heard extensive testimony from Rwandan witnesses on the contents of this newspaper and the broadcasts of the radio, and we heard from them about the effect of these articles and the radio. Now, in Kangura, I just want to point you to one piece of evidence. In an article published in Kangura number 9, appeal to the conscience of the Hutu, the introduction warned readers, wake up, be firm and vigilant. And the second part of the article entitled The Tutsi Ambition described the Tutsi as bloodthirsty and described Tutsi women who were married or sold to Hutu intellectuals as spies. There were cartoons depicting these Tutsi women seducing the UNAMIR leader, General Dallaire, for instance. It published what it called the Ten Commandments, and these commandments warned Hutu men of the dangers of Tutsi women. And the chamber found that the article conveyed contempt and hatred for the Tutsi ethnic group, and for Tutsi women in particular, as enemy agents, portrayed the Tutsi as a ruthless enemy determined to conquer the Hutu. Other editorials and articles portrayed the Tutsi as inherently wicked and ambitious, in language clearly intended to fan the flames of resentment and anger directed against the Tutsi population. We looked at the cover of Kangura number 26, which had the question, what weapons shall we use to conquer the Inyenzi once and for all? Inyenzi meaning the Tutsi, and the answer to that was a picture of a machete. The CDR party, to which John Bosco Baraguiza belonged, was formed to promote unity and solidarity among the Hutu popular majority, and we heard extensive testimony of public meetings held where Baraguiza urged them to proceed on a policy of exterminating the Tutsi. At these meetings, they used the word Tubatsemba Semba, which means let's exterminate them. And this cry was taken up by the Interahamwe killers and also repeated in these publications and broadcasts. The radio station RTLM was set up by a number of shareholders. The majority shareholder was the president of Rwanda, Habyarimana. And there was evidence that almost everyone had a radio. Radio was a much more important means of communication than is television in Rwanda. So everyone owned a radio station, and these RTLM broadcasts were listened to in homes, bars, offices, streets, and particularly at the roadblocks where we saw video footage of the Interahamwe were actually listening to broadcasts by the RTLM radio station in which the broadcast named people who were about to pass through the roadblocks. And one such broadcast informed the roadblock of the impending arrival of a UN vehicle which was carrying refugees out of Rwanda. And if you saw the movie Hotel Rwanda, there's a reference to that incident. And of course the vehicle had to turn away to protect the Tutsi civilians in the bus. And so we found that the RTLM broadcast engaged in ethnic stereotyping in a manner that promoted hatred for the Tutsi population, and that the broadcast were calling explicitly for the extermination of the Tutsi ethnic group. So to give you an example of one such broadcast, which was aired on the 4th June 1994 in the midst of the genocide, the journalist Kantano Habimana told listeners, "You should all stand up so that we kill the Inkontani and exterminate them. The reason we will exterminate them is that they belong to one ethnic group. Look at the person's height and his physical appearance. Just look at his small nose and then break it." So based on the evidence, the factual evidence, the chamber found actual acts of perpetration of violence on the part of the journalist in Gaza and on the part of Baraguiza, the head of the CDR political party. On the part of Professor Nahimana, on convicting him, the court said that we noted that without wielding any weapon, without holding a gun or without holding a machete, that he in fact committed genocide because of his responsibility for the broadcast on RTLM radio. We found de jure and de facto responsibility. Although he was not present in Rwanda for the latter part of the broadcast, we found that he was nevertheless in effective control of the radio station. Although he was not responsible for any of the individual broadcast made by the journalists. He was in a position to influence those broadcasts, and he was warned by the Minister of Information at the time to stop the inflammatory broadcasts and did not do so. There was a piece of evidence that when he was once confronted by an ambassador in respect of the defamatory broadcasts on the radio, which would have endangered the life of General Dallaire, which complaint was made to Nahimana, that then those kind of broadcasts stopped. So when he did have the opportunity to intervene, he did. And so the chamber found that he was in charge of the editorial policy of the RTLM radio station. And so I'm going to go directly into how we looked at the direct and public incitement to genocide, and under which we found these individuals individually responsible for the hate propaganda. We examined the central principles that emerge from the international jurisprudence on incitement to discrimination and violence, and we found that they serve as a useful guide to the factors to be considered in defining elements of direct and public incitement to genocide as applied to mass media. Editors and publishers have generally been held responsible for the media they control. In determining the scope of this responsibility, the importance of intent, that is, the purpose of the communication they channel, emerges from the jurisprudence. The actual language used in the media has often been cited as an indicator of intent. Critical distance from the broadcast or the piece of writing is a key factor in evaluating the purpose of the publication. So here, let me give you an example of a journalist in Denmark who was convicted for the broadcast of racist propaganda on the part of an individual or individuals whom he was interviewing on the radio. And this case came before the European Court of Human Rights, and it's the case of Jelisic, the journalist. It's Jersild versus Denmark, and this is where the European Court overturned the conviction of the journalist, and the majority decision affirmed that it was undisputed that the purpose of the applicant in compiling the broadcast in question was not racist, and the decisive issue in the case was how much he distanced himself from the racist views expressed in the interview. We consulted the jurisprudence of many countries, Canada, the U.S., and the decisions of Strasbourg. If I may just give you a brief account of the jurisprudence. In considering whether particular expression constitutes a form of incitement on which restrictions would be justified, the international jurisprudence does not include any specific causation requirement linking the expression at issue with the demonstration of a direct effect. In the Stryker case in Nuremberg, there was no allegation that the publication of Disturma was tied to any particular violence. Much more generally, it was found to have injected in the minds of thousands of Germans a poison that caused them to support the National Socialist Party. And here in the media case, we heard from witnesses that that's what the radio station and Kangura did, that drop by drop they spread the petrol across the country, which then ignited. Counsel for the defense argued before us that the United States law as the most speech protective state should be used as a standard, and that that way we would ensure the universal acceptance and legitimacy of the tribunal's jurisprudence. We considered that international law, which has been well developed in the areas of freedom from discrimination and freedom of expression, to be the point of reference for our consideration of these issues. And we noted that domestic law varies widely, while international law codifies evolving universal standards. We noted that the jurisprudence of the United States also accepts the fundamental principles set forth in international law and has recognized in its domestic law that incitement to violence, threats, libel, false advertising, obscenity, and child pornography are among those forms of expression that fall outside the scope of freedom of speech protection. In Virginia versus Black, which is a very recent case, I'll give you the reference. I think it's a 2003 decision. Virginia versus Black, the United States Supreme Court interpreted, yes, it's 123 Supreme Court 1536, the year 2003. So the Supreme Court interpreted the free speech guarantee of the First Amendment of the Constitution to permit a ban on cross-burning with intent to intimidate. The historical terrorization of African Americans by the Ku Klux Klan through cross-burnings, in the court's view, made the burning of a cross as a recognized symbol of hate and a true threat unprotected as symbolic expression. Intimidation was held to be constitutionally proscribable, I quote, where a speaker directs a threat to a person or group of persons with the intent of placing the victim in fear of bodily harm or death. These are the kind of case law and jurisprudence on which we relied to find that these three accused had, by words and written and broadcast, committed the crime of incitement. Before I conclude, let me briefly mention the crime of persecution, a crime which does not appear in our national statutes, but we had to apply it in respect of the same acts for which they were convicted on the crime of incitement to direct and public incitement to commit genocide, but also for persecution. Now, unlike the crime of incitement, which is defined in terms of intent, the crime of persecution is defined also in terms of impact. It is not a provocation to cause harm. It is itself the harm. Accordingly, there need not be a call to action in communications that constitute persecution. For the same reason, there need be no link between persecution and acts of violence. We found some precedent in the case of Julius Streicher, who was convicted by the International Military Tribunal at Nuremberg of persecution as a crime against humanity for anti-Semitic writings that significantly predated the extermination of Jews in the 1940s. So it's time for me to end, but as I said, I repeat again that as it is recognized that the media does have the power. I have 2 minutes more. Yeah, I have nothing to say. I have 2 minutes more. That as the important incidents, the role of the media in areas of conflict and in the new crimes of terrorism. The importance of the media to influence opinion is being recognized. But I stress that in the media case, the judges relied solely on the evidence and the context in which we were judging. We took care to mention in the judgment that we uphold the right of freedom of expression and that we see our roles as judges being entrusted with the position of finally determining the abuse of the right of freedom of expression, as well as the excesses in executive action that might make inroads into this right. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Pillay, for that informative discussion, particularly of one of the most important cases, I think, to come out on this field since the IMT, and probably in many respects maybe more so, given that the Stryker holding was very brief. Our next guest is Professor Diane Ortlinker. Professor Ortlinker is a professor of international law and co-director of the Center for Human Rights and Humanitarian Law here at the Washington College of Law at American University. She served as faculty director of the Law School's War Crimes Research Office from 1995 to 2004. I had the privilege of meeting her for the first time at Cornell Law School when she spoke about the International Criminal Court. She's written and lectured extensively on the scope of states' obligation to address mass atrocities and on the law and policy issues relating to international criminal tribunals and universal jurisdiction. It's a pleasure to have Ms. Ortlinker here with us today and to talk about the future of incitement law.
Thanks very much. My remarks are going to be focused particularly on the future of incitement law as it involves the appeal that is now pending before the ICTR trial chamber in the Nahimana case about which Judge Pillay has just remarked. Let me preface my remarks about the Nahimana case by just saying that what it takes to get the law right if you're a judge in an international criminal tribunal is not a straightforward matter at all. Like all law, the crimes that war crimes tribunals prosecute have some ambiguities at the margins, and when it comes to the work of the Yugoslavian Rwanda tribunals, there are ambiguities at the very core of these crimes. For example, the crime of genocide was not prosecuted until it was prosecuted before the contemporary tribunals. The Genocide Convention came into effect after Nuremberg. So there were lots of ambiguities, and when you have ambiguities in the definition of crimes, it becomes very important to determine what principles will guide your interpretation of those ambiguities as a judge before an international criminal tribunal. Very special considerations come into play. There are a lot of dimensions to this problem, but let me suggest just a couple to give you a flavor, I think, of the complexity of this question. One issue that has been addressed in a number of the decisions of the Yugoslavian Rwanda tribunals has to do with the question whether ambiguities in the very definition of crimes should be interpreted in light of the humanitarian goals of the crimes themselves. At times, judges have articulated the need to address their interpretive task in light of what they call the teleological objectives, the humanitarian objectives of the crimes, which sometimes involves a tilt toward a generous interpretation of ambiguities in the law. Pulling in the other direction is a commitment to what we lawyers call the principle of legality. Basically captures the idea we have to be very careful about punishing defendants for conduct that wasn't clearly condemned as a crime at the time they committed it. So there's a tension in the work of international jurists in this regard. Excuse me. A second kind of consideration relates to the multiplicity of audiences that war crimes tribunals have. These are tribunals that are speaking a moral message, laying down a foundation for future respect for the rule of law. And are acutely aware of their audience. Their task is complicated by the fact that they have so many audiences. When a judgment like the Nahimana verdict comes down, international lawyers and professors crawl all over it and write law review articles, and there's a lot of attention and scrutiny, which is, I hope, a good thing. But there's another audience that I think is more important, or I guess I want to insist they're both important, and that is the local community. Earlier this morning, I spoke about the sense of justice in local communities that are affected by the work of war crimes tribunals. How a judgment is received locally may be very different than the way it's received internationally, and international judges have quite a challenging task in trying to render verdicts that will be understood to be just and fair in all of these communities. It's challenging, but you know, it can be done, I have no doubt at all. In my view, the Nahimana judgment was acutely sensitive to the audience in Rwanda. I haven't been to Rwanda since it came down, so I don't know from firsthand observations what the local reaction was. But my guess would be that victims of the genocide were very relieved to see that the role of Radio Milkalin in particular was recognized and condemned. Anyone who's even a little bit familiar with the Rwanda genocide knows what a central role RTLM played in fomenting the genocide and, in fact, organizing it and directing it. And I don't know of anyone who disagrees with the proposition that those who were involved in the RTLM broadcast during the genocide deserve to be convicted. In fact, many of us, including Aryeh Nair, who was with us this morning, argued in real time for jamming RTLM's broadcast because they were so clearly central in fomenting the genocide. Now, that said, I have concerns about the Nahimana judgment, and my concerns relate to the conviction of defendants for conduct that was not, in my view, clearly defined as a crime under international law at the time the acts in question occurred. So I want to be very clear. I have no doubt that the defendants deserved to be convicted for incitement to genocide, and I think it was deeply important that they were convicted for that conduct. My concerns, though, relate to their conviction for what I will call hate speech, and by that I mean speech that does not incite the audience to violence, but rather incites the audience to racial hatred. And we heard speech along those lines. Judge Pillay quoted, the language is horrible and poisonous and harmful. The issue I want to address is whether it was criminal. And because I'm going to express some concerns about the judgment, I want to first convey my very deep respect for the intellectual integrity of the opinion and the work of Judge Pillay in general. Some of you in this world of listservs may occasionally have the experience of seeing somebody post a response to a message posted on a list service that they meant for a private party, and then it turns out it was posted for. I had that experience once, which betrayed my respect for Judge Pillay. Kelly Askin had posted on a list service relating to war crimes tribunals news that Judge Pillay had been appointed to be a judge on the International Criminal Court, something that Kelly had helped work very hard to achieve. I thought it was a personal message to me from Kelly, so I wrote back, "Yay, Judge Pillay, way to go, Kelly!" And then it was posted on Just What. So the world knows how highly I regard her, and so I'm going to express respectful disagreement with this judgment, or concerns, I should say, which I hope will be addressed in with some tweaking of the verdict at the appeal level. I'm going to give one example, though I could give several, where I think that verdict went too far in condemning defendants for conduct that, in my view, was not clearly criminal at the time it was committed. And the example I'll give, Judge Pillay already mentioned this. The defendants were convicted, among other things, of the crime against humanity of persecution. And there had not, in my opinion, ever been a conviction by an international court of the crime against humanity of persecution for speech that incited its audience to racial hatred but not to violence. And again, it's a sort of complicated area of law, but I'll just give the example of the Stryker opinion. I don't think the Stryker opinion at Nuremberg supports the conclusion that the crime against humanity of persecution includes speech that foments hatred and poisons the mind of the audience, but falls short of calling for extermination. the Nuremberg Tribunal was at pains to emphasize that Streicher called for the extermination of Jews, not just called for hating the Jews, but called for their extermination. They used that word quite deliberately in their verdict. They also were at pains to say that he broadcast a message of extermination at a time when he knew that Jews were being killed under, I'm trying to find the exact words, but something to the effect under the most horrible conditions in the East. Their point was quite clear. They were saying he did a lot of nasty stuff before the war, and the tribunal talked about his broadcast before the war. But they were quite clear in saying, we can only convict him for his conduct during the war, and that conduct amounted to incitement to extermination. And for that conduct, he was convicted of the crime against humanity of persecution. I want to, I'd be happy if there's time to discuss this, to go into more detail about some of the other aspects of the opinion. But they raised some other aspects of the decision raised similar concerns to my mind. Let me just close now, though, by acknowledging that I am very sympathetic to the view that Judge Pillay articulated and the view that the judgment articulated about the danger of hate speech. So I want to make clear, I'm not standing here as an American lawyer saying that the First Amendment ought to be internationalized. I think there's a very serious and important argument to be had, which is playing out internationally, about where we should draw the boundaries between protected speech and unprotected speech. But my point is that in international criminal law, as opposed to the law of certain human rights treaties, the line has been drawn so far in a place that requires incitement to violent action before people will be criminally prosecuted. My concern is I don't think that it is the place of an international criminal tribunal to draw the line differently during a trial. So it would be my hope that the standard that was articulated in the Nahimana judgment might be refined on appeal. And again, I want to just emphasize that I think the issues that Judge Pillay articulated and very eloquently in the Nahimana judgment deserve extremely serious concern. And I think her judgment was a powerful message of solidarity with the victims of the genocide in Rwanda. But I think I've made my concerns clear. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Ortlinger, for that insightful critique of, again, the Nahimana judgment. Coming to us next is Joel Simon. Joel has been Deputy Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists since 1999, before joining the committee as America's Program Coordinator in May 1997. Mr. Simon worked as the Mexico City-based freelance correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle. He's the author of Endangered Mexico, An Environment on the Edge, published by Sierra Club Books. He works in Latin America and has appeared in numerous publications, including the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the Columbia Journalism Review. Mr. Simon is a graduate of Amherst College and Stanford University, and I'm sure will provide an interesting perspective on the scope of incitement to commit genocide, particularly given his experiences as a journalist. Mr. Simon?
Thank you. Thank you, Eric, and thank you to all of you for your attention. As Eric just mentioned, I come at this from a very different background. My background is as a journalist. I feel like I've stepped into the lion's den here, a room full of lawyers. But I'll do my best, and I hope that I can look at this issue from a slightly different perspective, which is not so much focused on the law itself, but on the impact of the law, the perception in Africa that of the relationship between incitement to hatred and the genocide that I think is leading to a governments to justify repression of critical speech under the guise of suppressing incitement, and I have some examples I want to discuss. First, I want to talk about an incident that happened just this May when police in the diamond mining town of Mubuchi Maya in the Democratic Republic of Congo raided and shut down a community radio station called Radio Television Kasai, or RTDK. People in the Mubuchi Maya had been rioting for several days before this happened in response to a lack of drinking water and the postponement of national elections. And the station had provided detailed coverage of the unrest. The provincial governor there, Dominique Kanku, had ordered the closure. And when the Africa program director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, Julia Crawford, reached him by phone, he insisted that he had banned the station as what he called a preventive measure because its reporting had sparked the riots. And he said to Julia, he said, "Madame, have you not heard of Radio Television Libre de Micoline?" He said, "We have a duty to protect the population." Well, that remark illustrates something that we've seen throughout Africa, which is the way that African governments justify repression of critical media by invoking their duty to suppress hate speech. The particulars vary, but events generally play out in a similar way. Reporting on government shortcomings fuels political protest. Given the nature of African politics, political parties are often arrayed along ethnic lines. The government labels the critical reporting as incitement to rebellion or incitement to hatred, and either summarily shuts down the offending media outlet or takes action against the journalist. The government invokes the specter of RTLM in Rwanda and its role in stoking the genocide to justify its actions, arguing that it had a legal obligation to take measures against the media outlets because of their capacity to fuel large-scale ethnic violence. This practice, unfortunately, is distressingly common, so much so that it's become a major impediment to independent journalism in many parts of Africa. Since 2002, we've documented nearly 50 such cases in such countries as Burundi, Central African Republic, Togo, Gabon, Zimbabwe, and Rwanda itself is an egregious abuser. There, public incitement to divisionism is a crime punishable by up to 5 years in prison, heavy fines, or both. The Tutsi-led government, which consolidated power in 2003, has increasingly used these allegations of ethnic divisionism to silence critics. Such allegations have been used against Rwanda's only independent newspaper, Umusesu. In Chad, to mention another recent case, four journalists were recently sentenced to jail, terms ranging from 3 months to 3 years on incitement charges. What they had done was covered the activities of a rebel group and reported on alleged massacres. They were recently released, but nevertheless, those convictions sent a clear message. Of course, as Judge Pile pointed out, there are legitimate concerns about the media's ability to incite violence in Africa, and RTLM's role, as we've heard, in the genocide has been well established. Ethnic-based media, hate media, has also played a destabilizing influence in other parts of Africa, particularly in the Ivory Coast and the Democratic Republic of Congo. But in seeking to restrain media that engages in incitement and punish those that do, the international community needs to consider the ways in which African governments are using international concern about hate media to legitimize repressive policies. In fact, based on the number of recent cases, the misuse of hate speech laws by repressive African governments may well be a greater threat now than hate speech itself. In our view, the supposed concern on the part of African governments about hate speech is disingenuous. When it comes to hate speech, African governments are generally more likely to be part of the problem than the solution. As I pointed out, we've documented 46 cases in which governments have used incitement-related charges to harass, intimidate, and jail critical reporters, as well as shut down media outlets. At the same time, instances in which legal means have been used to suppress actual hate speech or incitement are rare. Our Africa program, which monitors press conditions throughout the continent, is aware of only one example in the last several years in which speech that could legitimately be classified as incitement was suppressed. This was a case in the DRC where an official regulatory agency suspended a political talk show broadcast on government television after guests repeatedly linked government critics to the Rwanda-backed rebels. A local press group accused guests on the show of, quote, calling for murder. Where hate speech and incitement thrive, in fact, they are generally linked to government, political parties, and civilian militias. We've heard about how this worked in Rwanda from Judge Pillay, so there's no point in repeating that. But clearly during the genocide, the RTLM served as an explicit instrument of government policy, not only inciting the violence, but facilitating it by serving as a means of communication between for the Interahamwe militia. The lack of precise legal definitions as to what constitutes hate speech or incitement to hatred provides latitudes for governments to interpret these terms in ways that bolster their own repressive policies. At the same time, it hinders the international community in its efforts to suppress speech that is likely to engender violence. To give an example, from November 2004, when the Ivory Coast was on the brink of all-out civil war and foreigners were being attacked in the streets of Abidjan, Ivorian state media broadcast reports denigrating northern rebels and their French backers. And this is a quote from a Human Rights Watch report. The television blended rumor, rhetoric, and news reports to produce a stream of xenophobic, rabble-rousing discourse which lasted for days. And this consisted of gory footage of a victim shot by French soldiers interspersed with exhortations urging people to take to the streets. Now, in response to this, the Security Council demanded that Ivorian authorities stop all television broadcasting inciting hatred, intolerance, and violence, and it authorized the UN monitoring and potential intervention in the Ivorian media. But the same Human Rights Watch report, quoted a UN source as saying his agency was crippled by the lack of a precise definition. This is the quote. We don't know in any meaningful or legal way, where opinion ends and hate speech begins. We need a set of rules. Instead of focusing on suppression of hate speech and incitement to hatred, concepts which are sometimes murky and hard to define, it might be more effective to focus on speech intended to incite violence. Certainly the legal definition is easier to understand and apply, and I think the Johannesburg principles, which some of you may be familiar with, which was adopted in 1995 by international law experts convened by Article 19, and it defines incitement to violence as speech intended to provoke imminent violence and likely to result in such violence, and calls for a correlation between the expression of and the likelihood or occurrence of the violence. RTLM certainly broadcast hate-filled messages, but the genocidal violence that erupted in Rwanda was not a spontaneous reaction to its programming. The station was only one component in a coordinated government campaign that included arming civilians, mobilizing the population, and organizing militias. Today, the absence of clearly articulated standards on incitement allows African governments to exploit a perceived correlation between hate speech and genocide to instead stifle legitimate criticism and independent reporting. The DRC's provincial governor's message to CPJ is just one example of how governments are doing this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Simon, for that interesting and well put together perspective. I have to apologize to Judge Pillay because I think we might have cut her a bit short as we now have some time just for questions before lunch. But before we do that, I would like to ask her a quick question which I think has been touched on by each of the panelists, and then maybe open it up to Professor Ortlinger and to Mr. Simon. An interesting part I find of the Nahimana judgment is its discussion of how to distinguish between protected speech and legitimate uses of media, and how to categorize that as opposed to criminal and incitement to commit genocide. And I think touching on Joel's discussion about the lack of clearly defined guidelines, the Nahimana judgment does a good job of at least specifying some factors. But how would you give advice to those in the media or to other actors who might be engaged in at least poisonous speech, but not rising to the level of criminal activity, to discern when they cross that line. Judge Pillay?
This is a 385-page judgment. And I would have loved to have quoted all of it. And I'm also very conscious that the case is subject to appeal, and there may well be arguments, such as Diane raised, before the appeal chamber. Nevertheless, I'm still very confident that this case has gone to a great deal of trouble to examine the jurisprudence and every piece of evidence. So you will find in the judgment we clearly singled out all the articles and words that we found did not constitute criminal speech. We looked at historical research, legitimate comment, and we said all these articles do not fall into the crime of incitement. They are legitimate. And as I explained already, the jurisprudence which we did not invent in this case, but which we drew from the European jurisprudence and also national jurisdiction, is clear that we have to look for the intent, the purpose of the broadcast or piece of writing. So we looked at the evidence and we found that some of the articles and the broadcasts indicated the intent to commit genocide. So it's very important when we look at whether we've expanded the definition and cast a very wide net, that judges will always be very careful to be satisfied from the evidence that the accused had in fact the intent to commit a particular crime, whether it's incitement or whatever. But since I have the floor, I would like to read two paragraphs of the judgment dealing with what you've addressed, but the attempts of the executive to curtail freedom of speech. And incidentally, after this judgment was delivered, when I was leaving and there were cocktails and so on, there was an interesting comment from an African woman interpreter in the courtroom. And since I'd like to hear from ordinary people rather than academics, her comment was very interesting. She felt this case was highly relevant for Africa and that it sent out a strong message to the media not to allow themselves to be co-opted into being mouthpieces of repressive governments. And she found that was very relevant for Africa. So, of course, I understand. I come from Africa. I understand some of the actions taken by these governments against journalists. And so I say once again that trust in the judges, that they will keep a tight control on excesses. The abuse of the right of speech, freedom of speech, and the excesses by the executive. So here are the two paragraphs where we said the chamber notes that international standards restricting hate speech and the protection of freedom of expression have evolved largely in the context of national initiatives to control the danger and harm represented by various forms of prejudiced communication. The protection of free speech of political views has historically been balanced in the jurisprudence against the interest in national security. The dangers of censorship have often been associated in particular with the suppression of political or other minorities or opposition to the government. The special protections developed by the jurisprudence for speech of this kind in international law and more particularly in the American legal tradition of free speech recognize the power dynamic inherent in the circumstances that make minority groups and political opposition vulnerable to the exercise of power by the majority or by the government. These circumstances do not arise in the present case, where at issue is the speech of the so-called majority population in support of the government. The special protections for this kind of speech should accordingly be adapted in the Chamber's view so that ethnically specific expression would be more rather than less carefully scrutinized to ensure that minorities without equal means of defense are not endangered. So we've very carefully distinguished between race consciousness and racial hatred, for instance. And then we looked at the European court cases, and we considered that the wider margin of appreciation, in quotes, given in European court cases to government discretion in its restriction of expression that constitutes incitement to violence should be adapted to the circumstances of this case. So we did distance ourselves from following the wide margin of appreciation given by European court cases to government discretion. Moreover, the expression charged as incitement to violence was situated, in fact, and at the time, by its speakers, not as a threat to national security, but rather in defense of national security, aligning it with state power rather than in opposition to it. Thus, there is justification for adaptation of the application of international standards, which have evolved to protect the right of the government to defend itself from incitement to violence by others against it, rather than incitement to violence on its behalf against others, particularly as in this case when the others are members of a minority group. So I encourage you to read this huge judgment.
Professor Ortlicker, I was wondering if I could pose the same question to you before opening up the floor to questions, just with regard to where in your mind, given the jurisprudence of the ICTR, the IMT, various domestic courts and other international tribunals, of how one, if one is a journalist like Joel, or one is a policymaker, where one draws the line. And then as a follow-up to that, presumably like as happened in Rwanda, where you have concrete evidence of a media outlet like RTLM, or in Bosnia, Radio Srpska, or others that are directly and publicly responsible for inciting genocide, what are the obligations of a particular state to take against those media outlets, if any? And how does that interplay sort of a complex question with the non-intervention norm and other sort of barriers to prevent state intervention?
You know, there's a clear area and an unclear area. The clear area is that it is absolutely not permissible and indeed criminal to incite the public to commit acts of violence. And since governments have a responsibility to protect their citizens from that kind of harm, they have a responsibility to prevent that type of broadcast, certainly to punish it. And I think a very compelling case was made by many people during the genocide that RTLM should be brought jammed by the international community, since obviously the Rwandan government wasn't going to jam a station that was aligned with itself. The gray area is what we've really been focusing on, which is speech that is part of a continuum that creates a, or I should, you know, to be careful along the lines Joel said, contributes to an environment of danger and hatred. I think that the Nahimana judgment did a beautiful job of providing an account of how that happens. And as an historical account, it makes a contribution to Rwanda's justice, sense of justice, I mean, to know, to understand the role that the radio played, not just in the immediate period of the incitement, but to understand how it contributed to a continuum of danger and heightened danger. I don't think, my concern right now is that the line is now blurred about whether that conduct, the conduct that's poisonous but not does not constitute incitement to violence, it is an international crime. In my view, it shouldn't. It's not. I'm not taking a position on whether it should be. My position is it's not criminalized internationally. There is, in fact, quite a vigorous debate internationally about whether this conduct should be criminalized nationally. And many countries have criminalized hate speech, including the Canadian government, which is represented by a number of people. And I'm quite sympathetic to the arguments about why, under some conditions, it would be appropriate to take an approach that's different than the one we do in the United States. But the treaties that Judge Pillay mentioned draw that line in different places. There's no uniformity of approach. Human rights treaties reflect a pretty broad spectrum of strategies about how to deal with hate speech. It is a subject of vigorous debate, and it's one that needs to continue to play out in many societies and internationally. My position is simply don't do it during a trial.
I really only have one point to add, and obviously it's not a legal one. It's just based on the observation of the reality, which is just I want to reinforce the point I made that the government, you know, to the extent that media engage in this kind of speech, it's generally as an instrument of government policy. I mean, in other words, they're directed by the government. They are an instrument of government policy. So in that circumstance, and I mean, you can look at any example, really, that you want to look at in which hate speech became a factor, the ones you mentioned are the Balkans or Rwanda or Ivory Coast. So the notion that the government would somehow intervene is really not the reality. To suppress this, and then the other question becomes then, well, if this is an instrument of government policy, and the media is an expression of that, shouldn't the intervention be focused on the government itself rather than the media? I mean, in other words, there's certainly an object maybe to curtail the speech. But perhaps the best approach is to put the pressure directly on the government, which is disseminating the speech through the media, and the media is just an instrument of this policy.
Yeah, and can I just add on that? I mean, I certainly would have no trouble with an international position to the effect that a government that itself foments hate speech, falling short of violent calls for violence, is violating its obligations to protect rights. And that raises very different questions than a position that focuses on the rights and responsibilities of the media itself. I think that is a very important distinction.
I think that's exactly it. It's very hard to find a case in which independent media operating independent of the government, or in some cases political militias or other violent forces within the society is engaging in this kind of speech. And if it is engaging in this kind of speech, you get into the issue of correlation. Does it really have the power, or is there really a risk that it'll inspire people to carry out this violence? Usually it's much lower when it's not part of some coordinated campaign.
Well, who to prosecute, or who should be prosecuted? Is a matter for the prosecutor, and I hope you will cover that, Mr. Ocampo. I also read this article written by Professor Fletcher, where he also feels genocide is committed by governments and people in authority. It was a critical assessment of the Kasesa Darfur report, which said there was no genocidal intent on the part of the government in Darfur, but there may be genocidal intent on the part of some individuals, and he was arguing, how do you find a genocidal intent on the part of the group unless you look at the individuals? So who would the prosecutor charge if he was looking only at governments? The Prime Minister? Now, in the Rwanda tribunal, the Prime Minister was put on trial, and of course he pleaded guilty. He's been sentenced to life imprisonment. But he also raised the defense as a matter of mitigation of sentence. And he said he's not responsible even though he's the prime minister, that he was really the leader of a very small party. And he asked us to consider that really he was a scapegoat. He shouldn't have been the prime minister, and therefore he's not responsible. So even governments raise defenses before us.
Thank you all for the discussion and answers to the questions that I have, and I don't want to monopolize everyone's time. We have about 10, 15 minutes before lunch, and I wanted to open the floor up to everyone. I'm sure there's lots of questions, so if people would line up at the microphones, we'll take them as they come. Sir?
I'm Greg Stanton. I'm the president of Genocide Watch and professor at Mary Washington University. And I just want to take issue with Diane's view that hate speech, when it is in the context of a direct and public incitement to genocide, is not contrary to international law, because I think, in fact, the two are very much connected. The Rwanda case is a very good example, in fact, of private, privately owned newspapers also used for hate speech and for incitement. As you know, there were many more newspapers than Kangura. There were at least a couple dozen who were advocating the same kind of hate speech. I think it's very important to recognize the difference between a democracy like we have, in which free speech is generalized and in which it's protected, where, you know, the Jeffersonian principle of sort of the truth will out through the battle of ideas and so forth, to differentiate that from regimes in which, in fact, that kind of freedom of speech is not permitted, and that was not permitted in Rwanda. And I never forget, I mean, I was in the State Department at the time, and I came back in 1994 in July, and I asked, why didn't you jam the hate radio? Why didn't you jam Radio RTLM? And I literally got this reply from people who were in positions who could have made this decision. They said, because it would have been a violation of freedom of speech. Now, if Radio RTLM was not direct and public incitement to genocide, I don't know what is. And that's what I really appreciate about the media decision that you have rendered, and so brilliantly, I believe, Judge Pillay. You have put flesh on the bones of the Genocide Convention's definition of what it means to have direct and public incitement to genocide. Thank you.
So we need to get this man up on the panel. Can I respond to that?
Absolutely.
I mean, Greg, I want to be very clear. I believe that the defendants deserve to be convicted of incitement to genocide. No question about that. The focus of my remarks was the part of the judgment that went beyond that to convict defendants not only of incitement to genocide, but words that did not call for violence, but rather created a climate of hatred. When it comes to the Genocide Convention itself, that issue was debated extensively. The Soviet representatives repeatedly introduced amendments, and you know this, to include in the draft text a provision that would criminalize not only direct and public incitement to genocide, but also incitement to hatred. And every time it was reintroduced, it was defeated. Now, you may disagree with that outcome, and reasonable people can. It's a great, you know, I mean, it's a perfectly plausible position. But it's not the, you know, the delegates rejected it. It's not in the convention. I hate to sound, I mean, I listen to myself, and I sound scarily like Justice Scalia, but let me say, with whom I don't identify normally. But, you know, the point is, and actually, as Judge Pillay said, the opinion itself was really clear that they respected that difference. Under the rubric of the Genocide Convention, they respected that hate speech could not be a basis for conviction under the Genocide Convention. So I just want to clarify my position.
Sir?
Yes, my name is Ted Orlin. I'm president of the Human Rights Education Consortium, and I teach at Utica College. I want to thank the panel for discussing this. The in-depth discussion, I think, is very useful. I'd like to add, though, something to the mix. In 2001, I served as senior consultant to the Finnish Human Rights Project in Pristina, Kosovo. And there we had the experience of what was categorized by UNMIC, that is the UN mission in Kosovo, as vigilante speech. That is, the papers would go out of their way to identify former members of the Serb paramilitary or former officials of the Serbs. They would not engage in hatred or incitement per se. You would look at the articles, and the articles were benign, but they would be identifying the people who everyone knew had been engaged in some kind of ethnic cleansing, act of ethnic cleansing, or perhaps even an act of genocide. In that regard, UNMIC took a protective, proscribable viewpoint and limited the speech of the newspapers for fear that they would be identifying people, giving their addresses, giving their phone numbers, telling them where they worked, and indirectly, perhaps they were adding to the climate of incitement without directly inciting. How do we distinguish that kind of situation in both domestic law and international law?
I mean, it's a legal question, and I'm the one person who's on this panel is not a lawyer, so I'll do my best to kind of answer it as an advocate and just sort of tell you how I remember this situation, because these are the kinds of issues that we look at every day at CPJ and decide whether, this is a case where we need to intervene. I mean, the issues are complicated there, but it strikes me that it does meet the definition of incitement to violence. I mean, the people publishing this information, their intent was arguably to incite violence against these individuals, and there was a likelihood that this violence would occur, and when, in fact, it did, there was a correlation between the publication and the violence itself. So by that standard, it seems to me, it's not protected speech. And I remember looking at these cases and deciding, in most instances, that this was not a free speech issue, and we did not intervene.
That sounds right to me. I wanted Joel to address this first because he has a better sense of this particular context than I do. One of the points that the Nahimana judgment made, which is quite right, is that, and they made many points that were quite right, but that's relevant to your question, is that in ascertaining the intent of and likely impact of speech, you do have to look at the context. And sometimes people use code words, but the audience understands what to make of them, and that's very common in speech that incites to violence.
If I could add just one postscript in light of today's discussion, I believe that the international community had some responsibility because of the time it took for the International Criminal Tribunal to deal with the Kosovo situation, generated the climate that encouraged the press and others to use this vigilante journalism as an alternative means of bringing them to international justice, and demonstrated to me the need for acting promptly and quickly in these post-war situations so that we can avoid this kind of issue.
Ma'am?
Hi, my name is Shante Lask. I'm an alum of this law school, and I interned at the ICTR and actually was working with OTP on the media case. And I just wanted to ask you, Judge Pillay, you mentioned in your remarks that a lot of the hate speech in that case was very gender-based, and I've heard criticism that perhaps that could have been better emphasized in the way the case was indicted and prosecuted. And I just wondered if you had any opinion or further remarks about specifically the gender component in incitement cases that you could elaborate on.
Well, I'd like to speak about the defects of the indictment and failings of the prosecutor in highlighting these issues. For instance, there was no specific allegation in the indictment about those cartoons that portrayed women as femme fatale. So in fact, it's judges who said that some of the propaganda laid the framework for the so that the accused should have seen the reasonable reasonably foreseen that there would be sexual violence committed against women as a result of the propaganda. In both the ad hoc tribunals, the judges are very careful to stick to the allegations made in the indictment. So after the appeal, let's talk about the allegations that could have been made on the basis of the evidence. I want to take this opportunity just to give you one example. The last speaker raised this, on why we looked at context and the effect of the words and not directly explicit language calling for violence. For instance, the word drum. What does it mean to you and me? But what does it mean to Rwandans? If you look back in history, the king's drum was made from the foreskin of castrated males, and in fact, the dried members hung around the ring of the drum, and then there was a great deal of evidence about the castration of Tutsi men. So that's what the word drum conveyed. So, and the judges heard a lot of evidence before we understood what the word drum, for instance, meant to people when they heard it.
Sir?
Thank you, sir. My name is Chidi Anselm Odinkalu. I work with the Open Society Justice Initiative. I'm gratified by the sensitivity, I think, that attends what's clearly a pretty difficult subject matter across the world. And I think the panel, it came across quite clearly in the discussions. I want to say, though, in the spirit of that sensitivity, that I understood Joel, when he refers quite generally to African governments, to mean some African governments.
Yeah,
and I think that is quite important, because there are lots of African governments that don't do that.
Yes.
And the tendency to homogenize Africa sometimes, and which clearly I do not think that was intended, but that consequence can come across quite often in ways that are not congruent with the message that is intended. My other point, though, relates to what Judge Pillay said. She pretty much anticipated me, which is lawyers out here quite often tend to get caught up in English translation. Because in much of the communication we're dealing with communication in other than English, French, or any of the European languages. And we're dealing with a social anthropology that requires transplantation and translation. And that social anthropology is lost. No matter the effort you make in the communication, it's significantly lost. You cannot translate it, you cannot transport it, and you're only trying to approximate that context, therefore. Following that translation, or attempt at approximation, there is then a completely knocked down, a CKD approach. So one word is then wrenched outside the context of this anthropology in which it took place. And in that context, of course, lawyers can make a heck of a lot of money and a lot of jurisprudence. The one thing that was attempted in the Nahimana judgment, I thought, was an attempt at capturing the anthropology as much as was possible in the context of judicial adjudication. But I want to find out, because there's a great deal on which there's convergence, and I thought the panelists also spoke to different things, consequence, intent, and all that. But between the extremes of First Amendment fundamentalism and governmental arbitrariness, which are real, there are real human beings who require protection. And there are societies struggling with a great deal of identity politics. DRC has over 530 ethnicities. You can't imagine what it is trying to forge something out of that. And the case you were talking about is clearly a case in which a government was being specious with its justification of arbitrariness. And governments these days, it's not just incitement to genocide, it's also terrorism. Every government thinks one machete or one word out of place is incitement or a terrorist act. And I wanted to find out whether there were ways outside guidelines and lawyers looking for more guidelines that governments can be, that we can, it's not usual that I'm sensitive to governments, but I want to argue for their case here since they are not here. Can we actually wait a moment and deal with the concerns of, let's assume that there are governments that actually are concerned about protecting their own folks, yes? And they are looking to do that. Can we spend a moment to just think about real-time concerns here of those governments and people working with them and spare one moment, one word for them? And I'd want to hear a contribution from the panelists on that subject. Thank you.
Well, yeah, we are hitting the lunch hour right about now, so I don't know if we're going to have time to address all of those questions or concerns. Maybe if each of the individual people want to quickly present their questions, to the extent we can wrap that up, and I'll make one or two administrative announcements when we're done. The first one is that once we conclude here, which should be in the next couple minutes, everyone needs to move to the dining room quickly, and please fill it up from the front of the room, from the back of the room to the front of the room. So please sit down in the back first, and then slowly fill in towards the front. And then anyone who has an R on their name tag should sit on one of the four reserved tables at the front of the dining room. And if we can do that quickly, because we have a keynote address which is about to commence, but in the interest of giving the three remaining people their time, if they can take at least 30 seconds to at least present their questions, maybe we can hold it off answering as best as possible.
Well, this has been addressed to some degree by at least Judge Pillay, but in reading over the last several years the Stryker and Frist case that came out of the Nuremberg trial, in reading your case, the media case, in certainly knowing about the Virginia versus Black case, one thing that sort of struck me was that history, and if we define that as elements or events and time, that history is almost like seems to be a necessary element of direct and public incitement. And I wonder whether or not, I guess that's the question, should some kind of history or historical context be a necessary element, be one of the elements in a criminal prosecution for direct and public incitement?
Ma'am?
Susan Benesch from Amnesty International. I'm a lawyer and a journalist and even a former staffer at the Committee to Protect Journalists. I'd like to pick up on Judge Belay's point about the context and meaning of language to underline another sense in which, to me, the media decision breaks ground in a both controversial and tremendously important way, and that is the temporal aspect. If you look what Diane pointed out, Stryker was actually convicted for, in other words, calling for extermination when extermination was already going on. Or look at the Akayesu judgment. Akayesu was convicted for calling for genocide when it was really already going on in many parts of Rwanda and about to catch fire in his own commune. Those are, if you like, easy convictions. It's an easily defined crime. But it is also not necessarily dispositive. Those are not necessarily the acts that actually cause genocide, since it was already happening. As was pointed out, there is no causal requirement in the crime of incitement to genocide, but the victims are most interested, perhaps, in what we could call the causal factor. In other words, what actually caused this? Why does Diane say that from the moral point of view, we're all convinced that the defendants in the media case should have been convicted? Because we're all convinced that what they did actually contributed to the genocide. So if you look, for example, at the Mugesera case, very interesting case in Canada, or at some of the actions for which the defendants in the media trial were convicted, one of the other troubling things is that they spoke long before, or at least somewhat before the genocide actually began. So that's very disturbing to lawyers, very difficult to define, and I would just make a suggestion, which is to look at foreseeability. When you consider the context of language and the meaning of language, and you try to figure out how the audience understood the word drum or inyenzi or any of these other words, you can say the one person who can be expected to have understood what the words meant was the speaker, the person who stands accused of incitement to genocide. And so an investigation into that person's understanding of language would be an important contribution to further defining the crime.
Sir, and if you can, just...
I'll try to make it quick.
Thanks.
Greg Gordon, Office of Special Investigations, Department of Justice. Professor Orentlicker, I think your main concern about the judgment relates primarily to Ngezi and Kangura. I don't think it relates, if I understood, to what RTLM was doing, because I think that was pretty clearly incitement to violence. It was direct, and I don't... Is that true?
Well, yes, with the caveat, as Susan pointed out, there were some issues about going back in time, though, as I recall, I think those may have implicated Kangura also.
I think that's Kangura, and going to that, I think in relation to your comments on Stryker, there was violence going on in Rwanda at the time the Kangura issues that Judge Pillay talked about were released. So in that sense, I think it may be consistent with Stryker, even though the opinion may not have explicitly said that. I think the actual factual conditions were such that it was consistent with Stryker. But one point I would like to ask, or a question to Judge Pillay, it begs the question of temporal jurisdiction, because ICTR has jurisdiction from January 1, 94 through December 31st, 94, and clearly those Kangura issues came out before 1994. How do you square the tribunal's temporal jurisdiction with the fact that those issues came out way before 1994? I realize you analyze them as inchoate crimes in the opinion, but inchoate crimes, as I understand them, are complete once they're committed. And so in the case of, say, incitement, even if it is an inchoate crime, it's done when it happens. In other words, when the magazines were issued. How does that square with finding them to be crimes in 1994?
Do you want to answer that question, or should we save it for lunch?
Quickly, yes. And even to the question on history, I think that we had our hands tied because we had to confine ourselves to the event of 1994. We did address the history, and we did say that we sympathize with the moral struggle of the majority population, the Hutu population, and we accepted that they were deprived and so on. So that is, we have to be mindful of the history. And with the 1994, we found factual evidence that there was a redistribution of the old editions in the form of this competition that was run. Your point about inchoate crimes and that we looked ahead of 1994, a long time before that, to say there were ongoing crimes. It's a ground for appeal. I'll be interested to see the outcome of that.
Thank you all for your insightful questions. Thank you all the panelists. Please again, fill up the room from back to front when you go in for lunch.
It was a little bit tough keeping it in.
And it's just people, it's a very emotional issue.
Right. I love the comments.
Governments are not availing themselves of it, they're participating.
You can put something together, right?
I mean, I think it would have been... Thank you.
Sure. Yeah. You know, then you should like, one month you visit for the egg.
Okay.
Actually, I was going to respond to your point exactly the way you ended up responding, which is that if those other early indications had gone to the temple
California.
Just
keep in touch with me if I'm there. I'd love to be
sure.
We go into meetings with them and say, there's some differences, but there's... but as soon as you say the word violence, then we're talking about the same thing. When they say, this was intended to incite hatred, then we get into a definitional problem. But it's still violent. I mean, ultimately, that's what it does.
I actually have written an article which is called "Don't Be Sure." I'll take a look at it if you can. my article talks about that. I mean, yeah. So
I'll miss it now. Let me just give you the card.
I actually gave a talk on it in Spain earlier this year, and I was with a bunch of law professors, and they just attacked me. I mean, it was worse than this. And I wish you had been there to help me.
No,
this
little you should see that.
Well, I have a confession. I was originally on the prosecution team, but in the early years, it changed considerably, yeah. I remember Craig McConaughey, by any chance.
Yes, yes, yes.
Craig and I were working together in the trenches. He's actually now in Iraq.
Yeah.
But
he was there, yes.
He's been to service in Australia. Mm-hmm. In any event, he and I were sort of getting, running. I was the deputy, he was the lead guy, and then James Stewart became the chief trial attorney, and Craig and I worked with him. And I actually was, I argued in front of the U.S. Court, but you weren't there one day. Frustrating. I know, I missed you. You should have been there. You happened to be, I think, on vacation.
Okay.
I really respect him. This is in Ahmada.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's good to make judgments, no?
So, I mean, this is, you know, in the direction of the power is, you know, better than
This is now the lunch break. Please stop the iPod now. No more.